All right, for those of you visiting this morning, we are going to finish our summer preaching series, which is called Confessions of a Church Planter. And this is our 11th week this summer on this series. And just so you know, real quick, I'll set up the series. It's a number of different things that the Lord has convicted me as one of the pastors of, thanks, Zach, of areas of weakness in my own life and areas that I see are weakness for us as a church. And so every week is a different topic. The Spirit has laid on my heart, and this week the topic is race. And we purposely waited till the end of the series for this one because we wanted to make sure your college students got to be here for this. And the topic that we're talking about is not just race, but racial reconciliation. What does it look like for us to reconcile from one race to another? And so we need to look at Ephesians 2, and then I'm going to share my confession with you, and then we'll jump into the panel. We read Ephesians 2, 1 through 10 quite a bit here at City Church because it's one of the best passages on the gospel. And we love verses 1 through 10. We were dead in our sin. Sons and daughters of disobedience. Verse 4, but God. I love those verses. Being rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead, he made us alive together with Christ. By grace we have been saved. It goes on to unpack that some more. But the part we don't typically read a whole lot starts in verse 11. Ephesians 2, verse 11. Therefore remember that at one time you Gentiles in the flesh, called the uncircumcision, remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Pause there. Paul talks about this incredible thing that has happened, that he, in his mercy and grace, loved sinners and forgave them and died for them, Jesus on the cross, like we just sang about, and provided reconciliation between man and God. Reconciliation is a word that means to be brought back into right relationship. So that relationship was broken. It was cut off because of our sin. And because of the work of Christ, now we have been brought into right relationship with God. That's verses 1 through 10. And then the very next thing he's going to talk about is how that vertical good news is actually horizontal good news for all of us, that we don't just have this personal individual relationship with God now, but because of Christ, but we have been born into a new family. A family that transcends race, gender, age, economic status, right? So pick it up in verse 14. For he, Christ himself, is our peace with one another, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility. Now, technically, Ephesians 2 is not addressing race in the same way that we're going to talk about it today. So I just want to clarify for those of you that are really good at exegeting the passage. Paul is specifically talking about the God's chosen people, the Jews, and everyone else who is not, which is lumped into this group called the Gentiles. But what he's teaching us, this principle in talking about the Jews and Gentiles, actually applies to race. Okay, and so this is not just a social issue. This is a gospel issue. There's a lot of debate in the church right now on whether or not race is a gospel issue. My opinion from Ephesians 2 that I suggest to you to chew on this morning is that this becoming one man principle, Christ being our peace, breaking down dividing walls of hostility between Jews and Gentiles, it's the same gospel that we need to break down the walls of hostility between races, ethnicities. So I encourage you to wrestle with Ephesians 2, that it's not just between you and God reconciliation, it's between you and others now, any other person who would claim the name of Christ, we have been brought into one new man. There's no longer these walls and categories. There's Christ and his own. And if you are in Christ this morning, if you have placed your faith and trust in the perfect finished work of Jesus on the cross, then you are born again into the family of God, and you are now completely a citizen of heaven. And there's no ranks, and there's no categories, and there's no boxes. There's one body, the church, and Christ is the head. Ephesians 2. So I want to say that this is not just a social issue. This is deeply a gospel issue. I also want to say this is not just about diversity. We could have a panel on diversity and multi-ethnicity, but that's not all we're concerned about this morning. That's part of it. Racial reconciliation is how do we pursue the gospel? How do we tear down through Christ these walls of hostility that have been built up by sinful men and actually be reconciled? Just having people of different colored skin in the same church or same school or same workplace or same family does not necessarily mean that racial reconciliation has happened. This is us learning to love one another deeply in relationship despite the brokenness around this issue. So it's not just diversity. It's more than that because the gospel calls us to more. So my confession, then we'll get into the panel here. Racism is an evil reality of our past and present. We all have various levels of the sin of racism in our hearts and in our families and in our churches. And this sin of racism has caused a lot of brokenness and continues to cause brokenness, and thus the need for reconciliation. I preached last September on race, and I shared much of my own confession and journey on how God's Spirit has revealed the sin of racism in my heart over these past 3 years. And I refer you back to that sermon because I go into it in much more detail. But my latest confession today, in keeping with the series, is that after preaching on it last year, last September, I have neglected calling you all to ongoing racial reconciliation. I was content to preach on it once and then challenge you to make friends with people who don't look like you and then leave it at that. And that is not enough. This summer, personally, I spent a season where I neglected pursuing my friends who don't look like me. Some of whom are here today. And the Spirit has graciously convicted me just recently of this in the last few weeks. My personal neglect in my relationships and my neglect as one of your pastors to lead all of you in this area. This is a result of my own selfishness and apathy. And it's a failure on my part to believe and love the gospel deeply enough. Ultimate lack of love for Christ in my heart. And so for this church, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And now, in keeping with this idea of repentance, let's get to our panel. This is me trying to make some right of what I feel like I've been wrong in. So thank you guys for being here. I want to do three things. Why don't you guys scoot down and I'll sit right here on the end. I want to introduce yourselves. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And then we'll share some stories. And then we'll talk about our faith and how our faith and race interact with each other. So before we start, I just wanted to say thank you for being here today and being willing to share your story with us. And we are, it is a grace that you would be here this morning. A number of you don't go to church here. Four of you don't go to church here. And so you are not worshiping with your family this morning to come and to share your stories with our family. And we are grateful. All right, so introductions, then we'll get into some of it. We'll just go down the line.
Good morning. My name is Ron North. I'm black. I'm originally from Tampa, Florida. 48 years old, so fully grown. I got four kids, 30, 26, 24, and 7. I'm retired, and I love God and his people. Good to be here this morning.
I'm Trevor Sumter. I am mixed. I'm half black and half white. For those of you wondering that, I get asked that a lot. I'm a junior here at SEMO.
Is your mic on? Is it on?
Yeah, it's on. Okay. I just turned 20 about 2 months ago, so I'm not full grown yet. but yeah, I'm excited to be here, and I'm also a member of City Church, so this is my local church body that I go to every single week.
Hello, everyone. I'm LaWanda Stacy. I'm light brown. That's what we're going to say today. I am not mixed, even though Trevor and I look pretty close here. But I live in Cape. I've been here almost 10 years, but I originally grew up in the Missouri Boot Heel. Most people, if you're from there, you know where I'm talking about, but most people in Cape do not. So I say I'm from the border of Arkansas. I lived in several different towns in that area, Caruthersville, Bragg City, Steele, Kennett, I think in that order. And so I am 32 years old. Sometimes I wonder if I am grown or not. But I'm married to this lovely guy, or handsome guy. I shouldn't call you lovely, honey. Right here.
Lovely and handsome.
And so I'm definitely grateful to Pastor Matt for having us here this morning and to share with you guys.
My name is, is it on? Okay, it's on. My name is Joseph Stacy. I'm 33. Yes, and you guys can see I'm black. So I also work at CCC, day treatment. Actually, my boss is sitting over there. Hi, boss. I'm from Cairo, Illinois, but I've been living in Cape Girardeau since January 2008, and I'm married to this lovely lady here, trying to get points. I got to get some points. So.
My name is Brianna Ray. I've lived in Cape Girardeau for 3 years. I'm originally from Flint, Michigan. I spent half of my childhood in Flint and half in Albuquerque. If you know the Flint water crisis, it is that same Flint. We've moved around a lot, so we spent a lot of time in the South. And my husband and I are both from the Midwest, so we are slowly making our way back up north. I am black. I'm not mixed. Both of my parents are black, despite of my skin complexion or color. That's what I am. I get asked that a lot. It's probably part of my story here eventually, but I'm glad to be here this morning.
Hi, my name's Melvin Turner, a member here at City Church. I'm a very tan white person. No, just kidding, I'm black. If you guys see me sweating up here, it's because I'm sitting in front of a room full of white people. It's a flashback to my wedding right now, so just bear with me. I'm from Kansas City. I'm married to Beth. We both work in the area here. She's a music therapist. I work at Verizon. I'm 27 years old. No kids yet, but that's about it, yeah. Been a member here for almost a year.
Okay, thank you. So want to take a good chunk of time and ask this first question. And if we don't get into anything else, I'm okay with us just talking about this first question. Obviously, there's a lot of things that we could talk about today, and there's a lot of stories we could get into, but wanted to give you guys a chance to share, what was it like growing up in America as a minority, or what is it currently like living in America as a minority? From your stories, from your experience, share with us what it's been like, and just encourage you to be honest and bold and don't hold back. Real talk, because we need to hear the stories told from your perspective and what you've experienced. And then as you share stories, friends, let's be listening with good ears of, is this different than the America that I grew up in? And how so? So we don't have to go in order or anything, but just let's just talk about what it's been like for you or what it is currently like.
They're all looking at me. I'm going to go.
Okay.
Okay, so my life in America has two parts. There's like two chapters. There's the before Christ chapter, and then there's the after Christ chapter. So before Christ, there's a way that you kind of look at race and racial relations. Before Christ, there's them and me and us. There's them and us. That was before Christ. And I mean, I'm not going to say that, I'm not talking, when I say before Christ, I'm not talking about my salvation, my going to heaven. I'm talking about before I actually realized what it meant to follow Christ and have a Jesus worldview. Okay, so there was before that where it was them and us. And I'm sure on the other side, I was them and they were us. And then after Christ, there was just us. And so before you get to Christ, there's all the things that there would be if you exclude other people. You know, they're wrong. They're not worthy. We demonize. We make up all these kind of ideas in our head of what they are or what they. And then once you kind of switch over, you go, okay, Christ kind of gives me a new mind. And then my mind is able to say, this person's actions might not be the best, but they're still another instance of me. What's your name in the red shirt?
Logan.
Logan? So Logan is just another instance of me. He's not them. And so that changed my life from whenever something happens, I have to react to Logan hit me, and he's just another instance of me, and I can just forgive him, and then that pretty much ends it. Logan has to deal with his action on his own. His action or his feelings or his emotions are not mine to deal with. All I had to do was say, Logan is just me, and that's it. I forgive him. There's no record of wrong. None. So when I see Logan tomorrow, I'm going to smile at him. I'm going to shake his hand. I'm still going to love him, and that's it. So you kind of have to decide where you are on that spectrum. Are you closer to the them and us, or are you closer to the it's just us? Everybody is a us. So that's kind of my story. Is like, I grew up, they're doing me wrong, to even when they're doing me wrong, I love them. It's okay, because it's just another me.
Yeah, so getting to see the perspective through their eyes.
Yeah.
And look past the way they're wronging you.
Yeah, let me throw one more piece in here and then I'm gonna be quiet. So I'm gonna disagree with Matt, but just a hair. So he said that the racism, that it creates a brokenness. Is that kind of what you said? I'm saying that you're broken and that's why you have racism.
Okay.
I'm saying you're broken and that the racism is just a symptom of your brokenness or disconnection from God. It's not that you're a horrible person. It's just that you haven't realized the truth about yourself yet. That's it.
That's good. I know you have more stories, so we might come back to you. Yeah. What was it like or currently like being in America as a minority?
Well, first of all, let me give you a little bit of my family history. I'm actually the fourth child out of eight. So my mother and father have eight kids, six boys, two girls. So that in itself is pretty interesting. You know, things were pretty interesting in the house growing up as the fourth child. But talking about my experience, you know, my experience is a little twofold. Growing up, you know, not only was, you know, I a minority, but, you know, I was heavier than all the other kids. I look strange. Sometimes if you see me concentrate, you know, you might see me hang my tongue out because I'm concentrating. It's just a habit that I've had, you know, different things about me, my quirks and stuff, you know, people didn't really understand them. So, you know, I have like, you know, not only am I a big black man, but I'm an interesting black guy. So it's kind of twofold. But I remember, you know, I remember things growing up, my mother and father, you know, they talked to me about race, but at the same time, I watched them love everybody, you know. So I grew up in a house where they welcomed everybody, and so it's kind of different. It's kind of different for me in that aspect. But I can remember my brothers and I being on the basketball team, and you know, because of favoritism, or you know, because of the coach's nephew was on the team, you know, he would put his nephew in front of, instead of just letting the skills, you know, determine where you were, he would put his nephew in front and stuff like that. I've seen stuff like that. I've seen people assume certain things, like, you know, I've seen people, like, I've walked in stores before, and people would have their children walking with them, and as soon as I pass by, you know, they hurry up and grab their child and bring them over here, like, I'm going to hurt their children. And which I understand that because we live in a different world today, but if you're going to be like that with me, you need to be like that with everybody. So my experience is being misunderstood, you know, people actually communicating and asking questions, you know, instead of assuming things is my experience. That's all.
That's good.
excuse me, my story is a little different than theirs. When I grew up in Flint. Flint is very white, black. It wasn't always the impoverished city that it is now. It was actually thriving with General Motors, which is what my parents and what my family is sort of rooted in. So it's not, I didn't grow up poor, but I did grow up in a city that was white and black. I say I struggled a little bit with identity because I look the way I do. For me, that was normal because my family looks like me. But when I left the comfort of my home or left the comfort of my neighborhood, there was always questions. What are you? Where did you come from? And that's black and white. So I spent a lot of my childhood trying to prove to my black friends, black teachers, that I am who I am. I'm black. I'm black enough. At the same time trying to prove to my white neighbors and my white friends that I'm black, I'm not white, I'm not like you, I have a different story, I have a different struggle. So I grew up trying to figure out how to balance that. Up until I was a teenager, if you were to ask me if I were mixed, I would take offense to that. Like, I would get angry, like, get mad, like, can't you see, like, I am what I am? So it took a long time to figure out that instead of getting angry, it was an opportunity for me to explain to people that black comes in all shades. I have three kids. My sons, one looks like me, one looks just like his dad. I get questions all the time as, you know, do they have different dads? I had a neighbor's friend come over one day. I was outside with my kids, and my younger one came out, and she asked me whose kid was I babysitting. It's my child. So I don't think people realize sometimes that, like, how offensive things are, or just the questions. There's a way to ask something, and then there's assumptions. So I'm very happy to educate now that I've gotten over the anger period. You know, people are willing to educate, but sometimes you kind of have to be a little more tactful in some of the things that you say, and you actually will learn people's story, people's backgrounds, kind of where they came from and what they've been through. So.
So there's a learning curve for white folk on how to ask questions, how to engage. Your neighbor's just trying to make conversation, but in doing so, disowns your own son from you.
Right.
And offends
to me,
you.
I know he doesn't look like me, but in my head, he looks just like me. So for you to ask me, like, whose kid is that? It's like, can't you see? He's mine. So it's almost like you expect black to look a certain way, to act a certain way, to feel a certain way, to walk a certain way, to talk a certain way, and it's just not that.
That's good.
We spent 6 years down south because of my husband's job. My husband's a basketball coach. Three of those years in South Carolina, three of those in Mississippi. When we got to Mississippi, and you're at this huge school, huge conference, there's a lot of speaking engagements that's involved. There's been so many times where people just will come up afterwards like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that you could speak that way. Oh my gosh, I'm so surprised how well you speak. It's like, I'm educated. I went to college. I have a master's degree. So does my husband. What do you expect? You know, like, I understand you're trying to express, like, maybe the topic was good, maybe what he was saying was interesting, but it doesn't come off that way. It comes off as surprise that there's two educated black people sitting in front of you in the state of Mississippi.
Because of the stereotype that black people are uneducated.
Uneducated. Can't talk, can't speak, can't, And you fight a lot of that.
So. Yeah. That's helpful. Thanks. Melvin, you want to talk a little bit? What's it been like growing up? How tall are you?
I am 6'8".
6'8".
Yeah.
So growing, when Joe says he's a big, tall black man, you're like, come on, bro. Get on my level.
You do. You do. That is a daily question at my job if I play basketball. But growing up, I have a lot to say, but I'll kind of keep it short. I definitely faced like an identity crisis. My parents really exposed me and my sisters at an early age. So we went to a private school, majority white school growing up. However, there was some diversity. There was, I was the only black kid in my class, but there were Asians, Hispanics, Muslim, Indian, Jewish people. I went to like 10 bar mitzvahs in my life. But I was really exposed as a child. My parents, they both grew up in St. Louis. They have multiple siblings, and they're the only ones to move from St. Louis to Kansas City because it was, at the time, meant to be a little more diverse and have more opportunity job-wise for them. They're both college graduated, young professionals, and they just wanted a better life growing up. They didn't. St. Louis had a, and still has a very hard stigma of racial, just being hard for black people, harder than it should be, less opportunity. But when we moved, I went to school, and I had a lot of friends. I was pretty popular, and it was not because of just sports related, but you know, people knew me. They grew up with me, so they knew who I was. So I was kind of in like a bubble of that environment. I was kind of protected in a way. I knew that wasn't like, because I was exposed, I did go to summer camps through my church, like with just all black kids. And when I started playing sports, my whole team was black, so I was kind of getting a taste of both worlds growing up. And I slowly realized that my school is just a bubble for me. It's not how it actually is in the real world from the stories that I'm hearing from my friends. And then my eyes kind of opened to how I was kind of perceived at in that school as just a basketball player. I was a history nerd, but, you know, teachers would ask me about, you know, did you see the game last night versus you know, asking other kids about the homework and certain assignments and stuff. And I started to see how things go, really, and how I would be perceived in, like, public. With that said, after my middle school, I, against my mother's wishes, chose to go to the local public school because I felt myself having a, I played both sides really well. Like, I played the black kid in the white school really well, and I played the black kid with my black friends outside of school really well. And I just really wanted to, I had an identity crisis of trying to be myself. Who am I in this world? And I just felt the public school, I told my parents at the time it was because the basketball team wasn't that good, and I wanted to branch off, but it was really that and a combination of me wanting to find out who I was. And that was a great experience for me. That really prepared me. Everything up to my life prepared me for college and jobs, and it really taught me how you can't always be, no matter how much you want to be, there's certain, what I grew up with, with my parents, they told me how it was at an early age, and they told me that I can't be out, you know, with my white friends in the neighborhood ringing doorbells and running away just because it could come across differently from as wrong as it is, as right as it, as people may think it is, it could come across differently because you're the black kid. I gotta walk outside, I have to have my ID on me. I can't just go out at night and do things I'm not supposed to do. They really instilled in me to...
like a healthy fear.
A healthy fear, yeah. Outside of that...
Well, then you fell in love.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So we met at Maryville in St. Louis. At that point, you know, college in itself is kind of a bubble as well in many aspects. There's a lot of people you get exposed to that you may not have gotten exposed to. Many of my teammates were in interracial relationships. Kind of, you know, it's a bubble, I should say. But as far as my wife, we didn't really start off. We started off as friends. To the dislike of, you know, a couple of her roommates at the time, they didn't really approve of the relationship, quote unquote friends, you know. But fortunately, you know, my wife, even though she didn't have the same background as I did as far as exposure, you know, she is able to see me for who I am and not, you know, judge me by my skin color. You know, as far as our public life, when we go out, haven't really run into anything crazy. Praise God at this point. Of course, when you go out in public, even when I go out in public by myself, you know, there's stares. I have dealt with racial profiling, you know, and even subtle things like I have a bit of paranoia when it comes to that. I just can't help that, you know. I admit that I'm closed off to opening up to people in my life, letting people in. But I'm very open when I get approached, you know.
Do you feel comfortable talking a little bit about dating and marrying Beth?
Yeah.
Beth, wave your hand.
Yeah.
Who's from Wisconsin, is that right? And your family and that very different clash of cultures?
Right. I'll just put a lot of people, well, some people know this, but her mother did not necessarily jump on board. The exact statement she made was, why do you want to date a black man? She asked that to her, not to me. Or she doesn't know that I know that, but, and at the time I was very offended. I had hatefulness, but as time went on, I slowly realized that at some point she had a vision of her daughter when her daughter was born, and her vision didn't include a black person. That's just the way it is. I've asked a lot of people, and I've asked questions of, do you envision? I've asked a lot of white parents and kids who have white parents, if you envision your white daughter marrying a black man, if you've ever envisioned that, if you ever thought of that, if it's ever crossed your mind. And a lot of them say no. And I think her vision was not that when her daughter was born. But fortunately, as time has gone on, she's gotten to know me. She's been open and asking me questions, and she's, as my wife would say, naive, but that's not her fault. She just hasn't been exposed, and I think it's incumbent upon me to show her grace and, you know, any comments that I hear, you know, that I do want to comment on and kind of correct, I just have to be patient and not take it to heart as much. So, but yeah, her family in general has opened up to the idea of it. They're very loving towards me. So yeah.
It's definitely been an adjustment.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure, yeah. Okay, other stories. What's it like growing up in America?
Yeah, I have a very different perspective since I grew up in as a mixed kid in a very small white town. So I'm from Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri, and I grew up in a very small country town called Iberia. So growing up, my brother and I were the only kids of color at all, and we're mixed. So think about this, every single person at my school was white, and every single person in the town was white, but my brother and I, and that's it, and my dad as well. So growing up in a small white town, it's a typical, like, call me the N-word or stuff like that, but it's the little things that hurt the most growing up as a kid. So my friends were very jokey, and they loved to make fun of me, and so a lot of the times they would, like, lick their thumbs and, like, try to rub, like, dirt off of me, but it's just my skin tone. So I got that a lot as a kid. Or my brother and I, we would, my mom's a very short, she's a 5-foot white ginger person, so people are very confused when they see us together. And so growing up, my brother and I were kind of like chubbier, larger kids, and so they would see us with my mom, and we'd walk on both sides of my mom, and my mom would be in the middle, and they're called us an Oreo because there's two black kids and then white mom in the middle. So I got that a lot growing up. I got called Oreo, or my teachers even called me cappuccino a lot as a kid. So like, just the small things like that, like, are the worst things I experienced. And then in sixth grade, when my parents divorced, as you can imagine how bad that was for us, saying it's a black guy leaving a family. Even though it wasn't the case at all, that wasn't the reason my parents divorced. My dad still lived in the same town when they divorced. They thought it was another black father leaving his kids, which is terrible because my dad actually became a Christian after that and pursued me. My dad's actually the one that led me to Christ. So seeing that, as people think my dad's a bad man because they got divorced, but yet my dad's the one that actually led me to Christ and loved me the most in my family and supported me more than anybody else in my family. So when I went to high school, it was a very pivotal time in my life because I went to a different school. We went overseas and lived in Germany for a few years, and I went to a school that actually had more kids like me, more kids of color, but it still existed. There are still always going to be problems there because I was in honors and AP courses since my freshman year of high school, and a lot of my friends thought, you must have bribed the teachers to get in those AP courses. You don't deserve to be in them. You're not smart enough, even though I had a 4.0 GPA coming to high school all throughout my younger years. And I was, when I tested to be in the gifted program as well, you had to get 124 on the IQ test to be in the gifted program. Well, I got way above that. My teacher still said I didn't deserve to be in the class because of who I was. And I thought that's ridiculous because all my family's in it and I should be in it too because I got 148 on it, which means I'm well above the mark to get in the class, in the program. And so things like that really affected me, seeing they thought as a student, to get your A's and B's, like they thought I changed the system or I bribed the teachers or they felt bad for me, which is why they gave me good grades, which is not the case because I worked hard for what I had. So then when I applied to college, my junior year of high school is when I applied to SEMO. I was excited the very first week of my senior year. I wasn't sure I was going to go here or not because I wanted to be an engineering student. So then I applied to Missouri S&T, and I was accepted into that school as well. Then I applied to be in the Colorado School of Mines, the big engineering school, and I was accepted into there as well. But a lot of my teachers thought I must have did something wrong because there's no shot a student like me who looked like me could get into top-tier engineering schools just based off their academics and their interviews, which was not the case at all. So that was a very hard moment. And then my senior year, when people kept asking me what was I going to be majoring in, when I first came to college, I was a double major in mathematics and engineering, specifically computer engineering. And people thought, there's no way you can do that. You're not smart enough. You're not good enough. You're just a kid from a small town who happens to be black, and your family's not educated at all. They heard the way my dad spoke, and my dad's he's from South Carolina, so there's a very southern twang to it, the way he speaks. It's just untrue that he's uneducated because he went to college as well. I'm not the first generation to go to college. So people think I'm educated just because my dad has a southern twang or just because of the way I look. They hurt me a lot. So when I came to college here, and my first two semesters, I went back home, and all my professors, my teachers back home were asking me, how was college? What is it like going to college? I mean, oh, things are going great. I love college. I got plugged into a church, a ministry on campus. Everything's going great. Oh, okay, how are your grades? How are your grades doing in college? I know it's a lot different than high school. Oh, I'm doing great. I have a 4.0 still after my first year of engineering courses and mathematics. And like, oh, something must be wrong there again. So all my success, was that contributed to me working for it or having good mentors and tutors or having a great family that supported me and pushed me along the way? They attributed that to teachers having pity on me because of who I was and where I came from as a person. So for my experience, it's not been the best, even as a mixed kid growing up in a small white town. And it's still hard to meet today because both my parents have great government jobs, and my stepdad's actually an engineer as well. And so my stepmom's a physical therapist. And so we never really struggled as kids for anything. We always had food on the table. We always had clothes. My parents both have decent cars. We had nice houses. And a lot of my family worked hard for what they had in their life. But as growing up and even still now today, a lot of my friends still think, they make jokes of saying, oh, your family must be, you know, there must be drug dealers in your family because you have abundance of stuff, which is hurtful to me.
So if you're from a family of color and you have a family that's successful and you're not in poverty, then people just assume that they're dealing drugs.
Yeah, and it's absolutely crazy because my dad's never even touched drugs. He's not even smoked a cigarette in his life. My dad doesn't drink alcohol. None of my immediate family drinks. They don't smoke really. So we've never even, like, they didn't even touch drugs. They don't even like the smell of, like, being around people who've done drugs. So just people think my family's drug dealers because they're successful or because they have a college education and they use that for their careers has really affected our family. And even now today, in the summer, some of you know, like, even my close family we've realized they've treated us badly over the years because of our race. And there's certain family members, like my grandparents are like, don't want to talk to my stepdad at all because he's a black man from Nigeria. And so, and they say he's not even a man. They say the worst things behind his back and say he's the most useless man in the world. He's done nothing for our family once he married my mom, which is not true. And they say he's uneducated as well, which he has a college degree in engineering from a school in Germany. So like he's a successful engineer. He's educated, very well spoken. He speaks 8 languages. Like he's a very educated man. And it's mind-blowing because the first time he came to America to meet my grandparents, the first thing he did was he washed both their cars, trimmed the hedges, and also trimmed the bushes and the flowers in front of the porch they have. So the first thing he did was to serve them and love them. He's done nothing but that towards my brother and I, my little sister now, and their family. But yet they still think he's a worthless man because of where he's from and because he has an accent, because he's from Nigeria, has lived in Germany. So even now as my family is dealing with this, seeing that there is racism even in my own family and discrimination because of who my mom has married. Both times she married 2 black men. So the things that we've had to deal with now as a family, seeing that my own family doesn't like who my stepdad is, who my dad is, who my brother and I are as college students still. And it's been a very rough season, especially this summer, dealing with that.
Thank you for sharing that. There's a misperception among white folk sometime that the prejudice and the racism was left behind in the 50s and 60s during the civil rights movement and the Jim Crow era. But you're talking about today, presently, this summer, prejudice, racism in your very own family. And it's still out there. Okay, other stories. Yeah, LaWanda.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay. So as I shared, I grew up in the Missouri Blue Hill. My mother is one of 10. She was number 8 out of 10. My grandparents had 7 girls, 3 boys. And she was the first out of my grandparents' children to get her college degree. She's actually a SEMO alum. And she met my father while at SEMO. My father's actually from Jamaica, and he played soccer at Western Illinois University. So they met. Okay, can y'all hear me now? Okay, sorry about that. And so they met, got married. A few years later, here I come. But my parents got divorced when I was 3, and my father remained in St. Louis, eventually moved to Florida. My mother moved back home. She grew up in a small town called Gobbler, Missouri, outside of Kent. You blink, you literally miss the town as you go by. But we moved back there, and you know, it was just one of those things. I honestly felt like I was in a bubble because my mother was educated. She got her bachelor's degree at SEMO. Her degree was in special education. So my preschool program, she was the director of the program. Also, after that, there used to be a program for at-risk kids that she was over with SEMO called the Talent Search Program. So she knew all of the administrators. She knew all of the teachers. They were her friends. And then she worked down where I'm from is Scott County. They have a vocational school. And so she was the counselor for the vocational school. So as I moved through school.
Switch mics there.
Okay, can y'all hear me now? Okay, and so as I moved through school, I dealt with, but a lot of times from educators, the things that I dealt with came from kids. It didn't come from the educators because it was like they knew, okay, well, we know her, and so she's kind of good, so her kid's gonna be kind of good, so that's kind of a safe, you know, safe situation. But dealing with the other kids, I remember, like, it was almost kind of like you felt like a little sideshow. Like, kids would come up to you and be like, can I, like, I'm touching your hair. Like, your hair is different. Like, and your skin's different. And I remember I used to get asked all the time, like, are you mixed? No, both of my parents are black. Both of them are, they just happen to be lighter. And they would see others. And, like, I have cousins that are of, and I sometimes felt like not only did I get racism from whites, I also got racism from people who were also darker than I am. It was like, oh, you just feel like you're better. So I was never good enough for the white people, but then sometimes I wasn't good enough for the black people either. So it was like I was in like this kind of situation where, like, okay, who am I? Like, I know that I'm black. I come from a beautiful black woman. I come from a father. And who am I? And why am I not good enough? Like, I feel like for me, and I don't know if these guys share this, but where I grew up at, I felt like I didn't have the luxury of innocence. Like, I knew I was black and something was wrong because I was black. Nothing else, because I was a great student. I was usually the top of my class because my mother was a strong person of education. You have to get educated to get out. Like, that was your way. Even if you decide to stay here, you still have to have an education. Like, I don't care what you do, get your education. And you have to be the best. And she always, one of the things that I felt like I was taught from a very young age is that you have to be twice as good as your white counterpart to even have half of the respect that they're gonna have. And they might not be halfway as good as you, but you have to give that double effort all the time and always be in good behavior, because as soon as you act out, you're gonna feel that. You're gonna be talked about. You're gonna be relegated to the back because of the fact that you're not the good person. Because I always felt like, oh, well, I'm good. People would be like, oh, well, you're good. Well, what do you mean by I'm good? Because they had, as Brianna shared, that a perception of how black people are supposed to act. So I was a good black person. I was good for that. You're smart for a black person. Really? Oh, okay. Or you're pretty for a black person. Really? I'm just not pretty. Just not smart. And these are the type of comments that I would receive. And then when my mother passed away when I was 15. So I went from I was already getting things from kids. So then after my mother passed away, it was like the bubble was gone. The bubble burst, it was gone. I had literally teachers, mind you, one of the best kids in class. I always just worked hard, I like getting good grades. And went from, okay, help your counterparts, you know, help the other girls. Because I went to a school, small school, Delta C7, when this one situation occurred. And so our class was 12 people, and there was 3 black kids in the class. three girls. And out of those, I was in the honors track, so to speak, in college prep courses, because we didn't have AP courses at this small school. And so I was usually the only black kid in class. And I was like, always like, okay, well, you go and you go help the others. And well, and I'm like, the others. And she's not talking about the other white kids. She's talking about the other black kids that have, well, they're just not as smart as you. Or then after my mother passed away, I had to deal with her. She used to put me out of class. And I'm just like, at every, she would nitpick, she would, and there was nothing that I could have done to please this woman. And I'm like, what in the world is it? And the only thing that I could come up with, because I'm greatly behaved, I get good grades, I do extra anytime, and I'm going beyond, the only thing I could come up with was because I was black. And because I was the smartest kid in class, because she didn't want me to be the smartest kid in class. Mm. She wanted others to be the smartest kid in class. But because I was, it was like, you know what, I'm gonna do whatever I can to kind of knock you down a little bit because you shouldn't be that smart. Really? And so these are the types of things, and I'm always not feeling like I fit. I always felt like, until my senior year of high school, I actually graduated from a school in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, Coconut Creek High School. And in South Florida, I tell people this all the time, the culture is definitely different. Like, I went from a very southern, you still feel, and even to this day, you can go there and still feel deep-seated racism. It's hard for me. My grandfather still lives there. I go to visit him, visit my other family members that live there. But it's so hard because it's such a darkness of racism where I feel like, oh my gosh, like I have to get out of here. Not saying that Cape, there's still things in Cape, but it is so much worse whenever you go down there. Like, you literally will walk in a store and people will follow you. Like, that's how bad it is there. And so, but
because they're following you because
I'm black and they think I'm going to steal.
They're going to steal.
Yeah.
They're just assuming right off the bat you're going to steal
just
from
them.
Just
because I'm not anything else, just because I'm black. And it's still that treatment in 2018. And so, but my senior year, I went to a high school in Florida, and the demographic was completely different. I went from where it was like 10% black, 90% white, to it's 40% black, 40% Hispanic, and 20% white. And so I finally felt like I belong, and I had teachers that looked like me, teachers that accepted me, teachers, even the teachers that didn't look like me still accepted me. It was just a totally different ball game where it was like, okay, I can finally feel like I can be myself and I don't have to prove anything. Like, I've always have felt like where I was growing up that I had to prove something. Like, and it was even to that point where even with everything I did, I could not prove myself enough. Like, my hair had to be straight. My skin had to look a certain way. And I still did not measure up to their standards.
So it was your senior year in high school before you finally felt like you could be yourself without having to prove yourself just because of your skin color.
Very much so. Very much so. And then even just, you know, growing, and then going into adulthood and even marrying my husband, you know, there have been times, and I mean, you said to be real, there's been times that we've been pulled over. I remember one time specifically, we were in Anna, Illinois. We were coming home because most of his siblings live over in Marion and Carbondale. So we were coming home late at night, and next thing I know, I'm like, what? He drives less than the speed limit. Speed limit is 55, he's driving 54. And so I'm like, there's no reason why we should be getting pulled over because he's driving. Now, me, on the other hand, I would totally get it. So I'm like, oh my gosh. And my heart starts beating because this is not too long after all of these situations, everything that you see on TV, everything that you're hearing, everything, you know, these conversations are happening with police. And we're in Anna, which is historically a racist community. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, Lord Jesus, protect us. And so the guy comes up, and I'm just, you know, and come to find out, he actually knew my husband. We shared this with you the other night. He actually went to college with my husband. But I'm sitting there after we drove off, and we didn't get a ticket. He pulled us over because of a headlight issue. And so, but after that, I was like, you know what, we were fortunate. Because this is not the same case. There are so many people that this is not the case of what they are dealing with. This could have easily escalated another way. You see it all the time because of a headlight, because of speeding, because just because there's a such thing called driving while black, that you got pulled over and you might not make it home. Like, that's a fact of life in black homes. Like, you do whatever you got to do to make it home. Like, even if you feel wronged, you make it home, because at the end of the day, your life could be gone because of the fact that you have decided to, you know, defend yourself. Because yes, that's what we were supposed to do. If I'm wronged, I'm supposed to defend myself. But I was always taught, you make it home, and we'll hash all the rest of that out later.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, LaWanda, for sharing that. Brianna, will you piggyback off of that? I told your story about Simon Says last year, but a lot of these people weren't here. So
just a little bit of background. My father is a police officer, so I grew up as a police officer's daughter. He started off in the military, left the military, became a police officer. When he left there, he still has a government job with Department of Homeland Security. So we've always been a part of law enforcement. So when I hear stories like that, it absolutely hurts my heart, because my father's a police officer. We've got police officer friends. We've got friends in law enforcement. But it hurts my heart because it's true and it's real. Even with my father being a police officer, there's always that phrase, let me deal with it, you just come home. Right or wrong, you just come home. Even as a female, and even though I'm not as brown as you or you or just look differently, there's always that never escalate, just let it go, bring it home. And so, like, I teach that to my boys. My boys are 5 and 7, and we work on respecting, or maybe even sometimes over-respecting, positions of authority. So my kids love to play Simon Says, and I flip it around all the time. Police officer says, fireman says, teacher says, just so that they learn that there sometimes may be a place where you have to respect, even where respect is not due, just so you can come home. And I teach my boys that as early as 5 and 7, because it was taught to me. By a police officer, that you will not always be treated fairly. You may be accused of doing something that you did not do. It does not matter. Come home. So it's sad that there has to be this fear from someone or some persons that are meant to protect, but it is just, it's a reality. It's a reality. And at some point you think that, for instance, like I mentioned, my husband's a basketball coach, so we've been many places, we've done many things. I'm grateful to be in Cape Girardeau, because it's not as high profile as a position as it's been where we've been in other places. But it's been times where he may have gotten pulled over for something, and had he not been recognized, you just wonder where it would have gone. It's just like, oh, okay, hey, coach, sorry, my bad, just get the taillight fixed. Where that was not the way we were approached. It was a hostile approach. Where are you going? Who are you? What's going on? Oh, Coach Ray. And it changes. And it should not be that way.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be that way. So again, it breaks my heart to hear stories like that, because, I mean, growing up with a police officer, I mean, it was just taught that. It was taught.
Yeah, so as a white boy, when I get pulled over, hypothetically asking for a friend, the only thought going through my head is, can I afford the ticket? That's the only thought going through my head as a white man when I get pulled over. Even if I was breaking the law, can I afford this ticket? And that's the only fear I have. The slap on the wrist of the fine. That's not the only thing going through your head if you're a minority and you get pulled over.
So can I tell the counter story to the happy ending of they just told me to go about my business? And so on my 20, and trust me, this is in no way to make anybody white feel guilty. God will convict anybody who doesn't feel right about it. So on my 27th birthday, I was singing with this gospel group in Houston, Texas. And we go every once a week, probably, we go to Walmart late at night, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, because there's nobody there. You can just get your stuff and get out. So we go, get our stuff, go through the line, pay, go out to the car, drive off. Now, before we exit the Walmart parking lot, we're turning onto the street. This cop comes this way, pulls us over. I'm like, dude, I'm just pulling out of the parking lot. There's no way I did anything wrong. There's no way. So we drive, we pull over. The cop comes up to my window and he says, hey, let me see your driver's license and registration or whatever, insurance. And I'm like, well, officer, what did we do? I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. He's like, well, just shut up and give me your driver's license. And I'm like, so of course now the young black man in me is like, okay, so now I gotta let him have it, right? So I give him my stuff, give him my information, and my friend is in the back and he says, hey, Ron, why did he pull us over? I said, because there's three black guys in a Cadillac. That's why he pulled us over. So of course he took offense to that. So I was offended, then I had to offend him, right? So he took offense. So he calls a black cop. Now, of course, for all of the people who say, oh, there's good cops out there, and there are, this is not that situation. None of these cops were good. This is all bad cops. So the black cop comes, and of course, he has to now prove himself to the two white cops that initially pulled us over, that he's part of the team, he's down. So he comes up to the window. I'm sitting in the car. I'm just sitting here waiting for my information to come back. And he comes up and puts his face like right here, and he's like, yeah, he looks like a troublemaker. Get out of the car. So I'm like, I'm just sitting in the car. So I get out of the car. He gets to doing his rough pat down, you know, punches me between the legs, trying to get me to react. But, you know, something happened between there where I was like, oh, this is about to go bad. This is about to go bad because they called this black guy. He's acting out. Like I said, aggressively patting me down, put me in handcuffs. Now, mind you, this is Ron, the singer in the gospel group. Like, not just a regular gospel group, but like well-known around Houston, Texas gospel group. So I get handcuffed, put in the back of the police car. And I can hear the radio where they're going back and forth like, oh, Ron North, blah, 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 no warrants, no tickets, no nothing. And so the cop comes, lets me out of the car, and I guess he had been kind of talking to my friends who were still sitting back at the car and telling them that the manager at Walmart called the police and said that there were three suspicious-looking black guys at Walmart. I'm like, okay, we shop here every week. We actually had friends who were cashiers who knew us, like every week would be like, hey, what you guys doing? And so the manager called the police on us. So my friend's like, so Ron, do you know, maybe you should just listen to what he has to say. And once again, I'm not having it. I'm like, I don't want to hear nothing this guy has to say. He's 100% wrong, 100%. Now, we made it home, of course, because I'm here today. We made it home. But what I'm saying is that is the opposite of, there's no way that should have ever happened. You know, nobody, I can probably with most assurity say that nobody white in here has a story even similar to that.
No.
Even, not even close.
No.
Like, you may have, you know, had some rough words with a cop or like, oh, you know, with a little back, why are you being a jerk? Oh, let me go. But getting pulled out of your car, handcuffed, brutalized. I had to go to the hospital that night. This guy hit me between the legs, like, really hard. And so it's kind of like that's our world all the time. Like, that's the one out of the seven times that I've been stopped by the police for no reason. I've been stopped for speeding. I've been stopped for running a red light. But I've been stopped seven times in my life for absolutely nothing. Just going to golf and stuff, play golf.
Yeah.
Going to Walmart.
Yeah.
And so I just said all that to say that we were talking about before, you put yourself in somebody else's shoes and you don't just assume that, oh, he must have done something wrong. That's not our story. Not necessarily. There's some people do wrong stuff, but then a lot of times people don't do anything wrong. It's just you're in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong, you know,
yeah,
skin on.
I think you guys, thank you for sharing that. If you're listening well, okay, you start to feel the tension in the room for why in our society there is this Black Lives Matter movement, and then there's the Back the Blue movement, which is a response to the Black Lives Matter movement because of stories like what Ron just shared. And unfortunately, it turns into black people versus police officers, which is actually not the issue. It's actually not a helpful thing that's happening in our society right now. So, Brianna, we have people in the room who either were police officers, who had family members who were police officers. So would you speak into that weird thing that has happened in the last 5 years?
I think you and I had a conversation about this one time. It becomes a black versus blue thing, and it's really not. I think what sometimes people are not understanding is there are black men and black people and people of color who are being killed and shot and arrested and abused by people who are supposed to serve and protect by a disproportionate rate. So it's not that we, and I'm not speaking for everyone, when I say we, I mean, I'm really talking about me or my family or the people who I know and love and care for, that we don't support police officers, armed forces, or anything like that. That's not the case. We are those people. My father was a police officer. My father was in the military. All that's being said is there is a group of people who are being targeted unlike any other group of people, and it's not right. What can we do to educate other people to make sure that that stops happening? So I was taught that in my household, I grew up in a big family. It's only me and my sister, but my parents were teenage parents. So when you're a teenage parent, you live with your parents. My mom was one of nine, my dad is one of eight. We lived with a lot of people. So I was taught that you're allowed to say whatever you want to say as long as you say it respectfully. So my father and I have a lot of like conversations back and forth where I tell him, I don't understand why to be a doctor, you've got to go to school for 8, 10, 12 years to have someone else's life in your hands. To be a police officer, my dad went to, and I'm not saying he's a bad police officer, my dad was a very good police officer, he went to the police academy for about 8 weeks. In that amount of time, how do you learn proper procedures, laws, things changing on a daily basis, how to not profile people, how do you learn how to properly de-escalate, how do you learn, you know, about drugs, and how do you learn CPR? I mean, you have to know all of those things to be a police officer. How do you learn that in that short amount of time? How do you educate yourself about people when you're trying to educate yourself about drugs? You're trying to educate yourself about life-saving measures. You're trying to, you're learning all these things. You're not being educated on people. And that's all about, I mean, that's what it's about. That's what the military is about. That's what our EMTs are about, our firefighters are about, our police officers are about. It's about people. And so you have, not as a whole, but you have a group of people who are being targeted by people who are supposed to serve and protect. And so your first inclination should be, what can I do to help you? Not, how are you going to harm me?
Yeah.
And that's not what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's hard having conversations with friends, because I have friends who believe the same thing. Black Lives Matter means you're against police officers. No, that's not the case at all. It just means that I believe that there's a group of people who need a little special attention right now.
Yeah.
And we need to learn, educate. Just the one thing I think that could help would be education. Learn how to de-escalate a situation. So
yeah.
That's my...
Well, and what I hear you saying is, even as a black woman, how do I try to extend grace to a police officer that blows it on the job after 8 weeks of training in police academy? And when I say blows it, I mean kills somebody. And so, like, that's crazy, but you're trying to, in your own way, extend grace to the other side, right? And this is what Ram was saying earlier, like,
yeah,
not just seeing us versus
you
them.
There can't be an us versus them. There's too many of them for there to be an us versus them. It has to be collective. Like, our neighborhoods are starting to combine, our schools, our churches, so there can't be an us versus them. I mean, at some point, it's just going to have to be all of us. So if it's your neighbor that you see being pulled over, if it's your neighbor that you see being threatened or accosted, at some point in time, it can't just be us as Black people saying something. It's going to have to be you. It's going to have to be you educating yourself, you understanding, like, something doesn't look right. Because it, coming from a person of color, coming from a minority, we don't have that same impact. We don't have that same impact. Yeah. There's been plenty of times where, like, I've been accused of shoplifting in a store, and, like, friends of mine have had to say, white friends, like, we weren't even in that store. She wasn't there. But it didn't mean anything coming from me. So it's just one of those things where, like, you're just going to have to learn that there is something else going on, whether you see it or not. There's something going on, and there has to be this fading of this us versus them mentality.
Yeah.
Just we're taught, I think. I mean, at least I know I was taught respect, you know, and to love and to forgive those who have done wrong, and that extends whether it's something racist, whether it's something physical, like I was just taught to forgive. At some point you have to forgive. That's the only way you can move on. So it's sometimes it's easier, like when you're in circumstances like that, to say, like, okay, you were taught differently than I was, so maybe that's the way you reacted that way. But that doesn't mean that it's right.
Yeah, so. Thanks. So how does the gospel come into this conversation? I don't know if you feel this, like, tension building, like we need a person of peace to enter into this, right? To break down the walls of hostility, Ephesians 2.
The gospel is the answer. That's the beautiful part. It is, if you go to the gospels, you know that the Bible says, love your neighbor. Who's my neighbor? Everybody. But if you start with love your enemy and work back from there, there's pretty much nobody left. If you start with, I love my enemy, and it doesn't mean love your enemy if they treat you right, if they, you know, do what you want them to do, if they behave or subscribe to the same beliefs you subscribe to, that doesn't even enter into it. If you look at the story about the Good Samaritan, like, you know, this guy that he helped was, like, in society was his literal enemy. Like, these people, we don't even touch them. We don't put our physical hand on them because that's how they've been demonized in our culture. But this guy comes and he puts him on his horse and he takes him to the inn and he gives him all his money and he says, look, if that's not enough, I'll come back and I'll give you some more money. So that's kind of how you have to look at everybody. Like, if this person is in need or if this person is hurting, then it's not just a good deed. It's my responsibility, especially if you say that you're a follower of Christ.
Yeah.
Now, if you're just a worldly guy who believes I'm going to get all that I can get, I don't have no answers for you. But us, the ones that profess this, the answer is right there. Love your enemy. Love your neighbor. Love everybody. And what does that love mean? It's spelled out in here. You got to go broke. You got to get, because it all belongs to Christ anyway.
Yeah.
Once you start thinking that some of this stuff is yours, you've already lost. You've already lost. When you think that's your car, no, it's not. That car is given to you by Christ for his kingdom.
Yeah.
This is not your church. This is God's church. This is not your city. It's God's city. So everybody in here has value, worth, and God loves them just like he loves you.
Yeah.
Everybody.
That's good.
So, I'm done.
I think the gospel is what allows us to suffer for his sake. This is something I've been wrestling in this summer, doing what I've been doing with my family. So Philippians 1:12, I want you to know, brothers, that what's happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. I think if you're looking at Paul and how he was persecuted heavily, he had snake bites that almost killed him, shipwrecked multiple times, put in prison, beaten, almost to the point of death multiple times. If he can sit in a prison and say that what he's going through advances, has been happened to serve to advance the gospel, why can't we as people as well? I think most of the time I have not experienced anything like he experienced. I have not been beaten nearly to death any times. I've never been put in prison just because of my faith. So I think as people, if we're looking at the gospel as a means to advance who Christ is, we should at all times. We're not suffering just because we're suffering. We're suffering to advance the gospel. And that's why Philippians 1:29 says, "For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake." Like he said, it's granted to us. It's a gift to suffer for his sake. We see blessings as something only good. We don't see as bad things also as a blessing from Christ as well. So I think as people, if we look at the gospel, we can realize that suffering is a good thing. If it means that we can advance the gospel through it. So if we're looking at the gospel, like, as Ron said, as we're to love our neighbors as ourselves, if we're looking at the gospel, Christ has loved us even as people who hated him. We all, before Christ, hated Christ with everything. We sinned against him. We mocked him. We are the reason why he went to the cross. If Christ didn't go to the cross for us sinners who hated and mocked him as our loving Father, we should be able to do the same with those who hate us as well.
I want to say to you guys, Psalms 133 and 1, "Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity." I honestly believe this is something my husband and I have talked about for probably the last couple of years. I honestly believe that the church is going to be the model of to show the world how we are supposed to dwell in unity. How blacks, how whites, how Hispanics, how Asians. Because at the end of the day, when we go to heaven, there ain't gonna be a black section, there ain't gonna be a white section, there ain't gonna be loud singers, soft singers, soft praisers, soft worshipers. There is not going to be that. There's going to be, there is one heaven, there is one sound that we as the church will make. And so the thing that I have learned, and just because I have been in a lot of spaces where I've been the only person that has a little darker tan than other in the room, that I believe there's a lack of empathy, a lack of, okay, how does it feel? We just want to have an opinion. We just want to say, but how does it make you feel? To have these open conversations, that's what I appreciate about Matt doing this, because to have that, because you're asking, how does it feel to be black in America? How does it feel? Because there's so many things where we, you know, all of us, there's a lot of times we're not given those opportunities to openly say, how does it make you feel? Because a lot of times that is met with combativeness. It's met with, oh, I'm taking offense to that, because, you know, a lot of times black people, we can be very demonstrative. And it's not that I'm coming to against you, or I know I can be very demonstrative and I talk with my hands as I'm doing now, but it's just that I, you know, there's so much and you see so much. But the thing that I'm appreciative for is because of the fact that I know Jesus, and I know that his blood was red, and that it was for me that he went, and for each and every person in that room. It wasn't for white blood, it wasn't for black blood. Whenever you do it, whenever they take your blood test, you got type A, and that don't mean you type A because you white. But that don't mean you type B because you black. No, it's because all of us are the same. Our blood, when you take away the skin, our blood is the same.
Yeah.
And so that is what where the gospel comes in, is that we have to understand that we are one people. That at the end of the day, yes, we have all been through circumstances, as you have heard from each of us today, but we are all the same. And that what one thing that you can do is whenever you see somebody else on the street that doesn't look like you, ask them, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How are you seeing? Because they see the same news that you see. We see the same things that you see. But how does that make you feel? How is it to walk in your shoes? Can you tell me? There's the music.
Yeah, thank you. My wife is in the preschool this morning, and we are well past our normal time that we dismiss, but I don't want to leave, but we need to respect those that are serving with our kids, especially the ones that have my four-year-old this morning. Man, guys, I love what LaWanda said about we all bleed red, and so did Christ. And we sang it earlier, the power of his blood. We're going to sing Nothing But the Blood here in a minute. It's this reminder that Christ died and shed his blood. He suffered injustice. He suffered injustice out of a love for you and for me and an obedience to his father. And if you're here this morning and you've suffered injustice before, you have a sympathetic high priest. Jesus Christ has been there. He's been pulled over and cuffed for being at Walmart. That's the cross. So for those of you that have experienced that, you're not alone. You have a sympathetic high priest that has suffered in our place. And if you're here this morning and you're not a minority, I pray that our conversation this morning, the Lord has helped you to have better eyes to see this issue. But let us not leave here without celebrating the unity that we do have in the gospel. And that the kingdom of God is building himself a family, a kingdom from every tribe, every tongue, every color, every nation. And Luando's right. We will spend eternity worshiping the cross and the blood of Christ that was shed for all of us. And we can go from this place in unity as brothers and sisters, regardless of race, age, gender, ethnicity, economic status, right? The walls of hostility can come down because of Christ.